The Spectator's podcast now have a newsletter. Sign up for free at spectator.co.uk/podcast-highlights to get the Spectator's podcast highlights in your inbox every Monday.
Hello and welcome to a special Saturday edition of Coffee House Shots. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth and defence editor of The Times, Lucy Fisher. As the government attempts to get back to normal, or at least the new normal, sorry to use that term, lots of pieces from the election agenda are re-emerging. And one other thing that's going on is the Defence Review, which is looking at changes to the military and others as we know it. There have been several reports about Dominic Cummings' thoughts on this. He's planning to visit some of the MOD sites in the coming weeks. And there's speculation that this could see big cuts to the military as we know it. So to find out what's going on and what various sides of government want to happen, James, what are the government trying to achieve if you think about number 10 from the Defence Review?
I think the aim is to make it a kind of integrated security review. So don't just look at the Army, the Air Force and the Navy, but to look at that in the context of also cyber warfare, development, the UK's overall foreign policy strategy. And I think we've already seen two things essentially taken out of the Defence Review and pulled out of its integrated security review and pulled forward. One of them is the China policy, the shift to basically be an active policy of trying to reduce dependence on China at every stage. I think we will see another element of that coming on Tuesday when we get the government's decision on whether Huawei will, after all, be allowed to be involved in the building of the UK's 5G network. And then the decision to merge together the Foreign Office and DFID. I think the challenge now is going to be, how do you balance up the fact that it used to be that there was kind of one theatre of war, a kind of physical space? There is now both the physical space and cyberspace. And at a time when you've got pressure on the public finances, what are you going to do? Are you going to spend more to maintain a presence in both areas? Or is the physical budget going to have to give to boost spending on the cyber stuff?
Lucy, what's the sense if we look at the military and, you know, the MOD? Is there a sense of, I suppose, caution or concern about what this review could bring?
Well, I think there's certainly a sense of trepidation at this government's sort of intent. Dominic Cummings, as we know, is taking a very close personal interest. Anyone would know from looking at his blog over the years that he has a deep and long-standing interest and knowledge of defence matters. So I think people are, as you say, cautious, perhaps a sense of trepidation, because they know that he's a disruptor. He's not afraid of really shaking things up. And he's been incredibly opinionated before about how he thinks that the MOD's handling of procurement is disastrous. He's very interested in some of the more agile, quick-to-produce technology. You know, one of his blogs talks about drone swarms that are controlled via iPhone. That's the kind of technology he's really interested in, along with some of the military applications of futuristic technologies like advanced robotics, AI. So I think that's all really exciting, looking at how we can modernise the military, and people are excited about that. I think there's more concern for his views about some of the legacy platforms, really big, expensive numbers, like Britain's aircraft carriers that together cost £6.2 billion. He's called that programme a farce. And I think people are concerned that there may be moves afoot now to try and kind of move on from those really complicated procurement programmes for big platforms to a new way of doing things, and what that might mean for the military.
And James, where does Ben Wallace sit in all this? He's the Defence Secretary, but there have been reports in the past that he doesn't have perhaps the most rosy relationship with number 10.
Ben Wallace is kind of one of Boris Johnson's old political allies. I think at the time of the last reshuffle, there was lots of speculation about whether he would survive it or not. And in the end, he did. There is clearly some tension there. I think the other big question about this review is, you know, how do you balance out all the different things? Because you can make, as Lucy was saying, you can make these arguments about technology and aircraft carriers are out of date and all these things. But there is also no doubt that in terms of international standing and the UK's kind of reputation as a military power, the ability to sail an aircraft carrier through the South China Seas is a very important part of that force projection. And then also that you get added to that another issue, which is how this plays back into domestic politics. One of Boris Johnson's views on how you save the Union is that he thinks that you build far more ships in Scottish shipyards. And again, so all of these things come together. And I think it is also worth remembering two things. One is Tory backbench opinion will be very quick to react if it thinks that the conventional military is being cut back to pay for more things in cyberspace. That will not be a popular position within the Conservative parliamentary party. I think that is a kind of important factor to bear in mind here. And then the second is, we know that Barack Obama warned David Cameron, you know, basically, if you don't hit that 2% NATO target, the special relationship goes or becomes downgraded, to put it like that. And I think that will be something that the UK will also be conscious of, which is, even if President Trump loses in November, I don't think this American desire to get NATO member states to hit the 2% target is going to go. And I mean, there will be particular pressure on the UK, which is, look, if you want to regard yourself as the US's leading military ally in Europe, you've got to be setting an example of the 2% and not just hitting it, but comfortably exceeding it.
Lucy, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think James makes some really interesting points there. I think it's right that, you know, defence cuts are never sort of going to be popular. But I also, you know, foresee a scenario in which the government sticks to its manifesto commitment to hit the 2% of GDP defence spending and possibly the 0.5% increase above inflation year on year throughout Parliament. But yet that could still see a real-term cut if the economy fares as badly as some of the most alarming economic forecasts in the wake of the coronavirus crisis. And one thing I do think it's worth pointing out, and I'd be interested in James's opinion on this, is that it seems to me that the makeup of the Conservative Party now, particularly with the influx of some of the Red Wall MPs who have slightly different priorities, may be less focused on defence and that sort of traditional sector than previous cohorts of Conservative Party backbenchers. So I'm not as convinced that Boris Johnson faces as big a rebellion if he attempts to cut the forces. And I think we saw how easily the party got away with, as it were, dropping from its manifesto in December its target that was previously there to keep the army at 82,000 personnel. I'd be very surprised if the army doesn't take quite a significant cut in terms of people and soldiers. The bigger picture, which James touches on NATO and how we kind of try and keep the US involved, because, of course, there's been a lot of concern in recent years about Donald Trump's ambivalence to the alliance, which is the absolute cornerstone of Western defence. James is right to point out that that actually started a sort of a generation earlier with Barack Obama. But I think that, you know, even the UK meeting that 2% target, only 9 of the 30 NATO members meet that target. So there is this sense that not all allies are fairly shouldering the burden of defence. But I also think that the US's attitude towards it, the US's sort of pivot and interest in China, means that the UK has to be thinking more broadly than just NATO. So I think looking ahead, I'm very interested to see what this integrated review says about the UK looking to deepen defence relationships with Japan, which is something the MOD has been concentrating on in recent years. Also, perhaps other lesser-known alliances. We're part of something called the Five Powers Defence Agreements, which is an alliance between the UK, Australia, New Zealand, Malaysia and Singapore. And I think as our interest in China and the Indo-Pacific begins to increase, that these are sort of the alliances that may take more centre stage in coming years.
And James, when we're talking about this review, has much changed from Mark Sedwill being on the way out of government? We know that he is no longer going to be in the role of National Security Advisor from September, I believe, also not in the role of Cabinet Secretary. But he had clearly very strong opinions on what UK defence should be doing. So how does his incoming or upcoming absence influence all this?
This is much more Lucy's area of expertise than mine, but I suspect that the service chiefs were not disappointed to see Mark Sedwill go. Mark Sedwill was a big advocate of shifting spending away from traditional military forces onto things in the cyber theatre. So I don't think he was someone who was kept up at night by worrying about the size of the army. He was far more worried about cyber threats. So I think that is a change. I think also although the military haven't been brilliant at making this argument, I also think there is an element to the way in which coronavirus has slightly changed things. I think if you look at the construction of the Nightingale hospitals, these mobile testing units, there is no doubt that the military is one of the few bits of the British state that has worked during this coronavirus crisis and has bailed the government out of trouble in various areas. I think the military would be well advised to start making the argument that they are a domestic resilience force as well as being a tool of British foreign policy.
You know, I agree with you. I was surprised that, in a way, the military didn't do more, and Ben Wallace wasn't put out more on the airwaves to really promote some of the fantastic work they did at very short notice, you know, working through the night in many sort of scenarios to deliver ventilators and PPE, mobile testing units, building the Nightingale hospitals, as you said. And yet, I think we also have to acknowledge that in British society, there is a deep unease about having to rely on the military. I'm not quite sure why that is. It's something you don't see in France or some other European nations where people are more comfortable with seeing personnel in uniform being involved. But it's my sense that in the UK, it's somehow seen as a failure of government and civil society if the military have to be called in. So I'm not quite sure about how quickly attitudes could move on that to facilitate the military having that bigger role in resilience, for which they're really, really well suited, that you suggest, James.
And Lucy, how does Trident fit into all this? Obviously a huge sum of money. So do we expect this to keep staying in this group of spending?
Well, I think that's a really good question, because the cost of Trident is just so colossal. On the one hand, it's key to us keeping, you know, our sort of standing on the world stage. It's one of the key capabilities, I'd say, along with GCHQ, that is really admired by the US and considered valuable. You know, the rest of our forces, our army is really now too small to be of much use to the US other than to just plug in with their forces if it came to it. But Trident's very, very key to the special relationship. But already at the moment, we're seeing the costs of the Dreadnought class submarines, the latest ones that are coming in. You know, that's set to cost about 30 billion in the course of its lifetime. I think, you know, in the wake of the pandemic, serious concerns about the government debt levels, other sort of major programs are going to receive a lot of scrutiny. And I think we're going to see debate over Trident renewed.
Thank you, Lucy. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening. And while we have you here, I would like to promote an event that we're having next week. It's on Thursday. And as is the way these days, it is an online event rather than us all crowding in a room wearing masks. You'll be hearing from the usual Coffee House Shots panel and a very special guest, Andrew Neil. And we'll be discussing coronavirus lessons learned, the extraordinary events of the last few months, and taking questions from the audience on what went wrong and what could go right going forwards. To get a ticket, just go to www.spectator.co.uk/lessons. That's next Thursday, the 16th of July, and it's at 6 p.m.